So welcome to lecture three. Thanks for sticking around. Our job is to try and understand the equations of Harrispin gravity scribbled up there. We do not understand them yet. What we've done so far is to become really good at the linearized theory of free massless fields. Okay, so we took the spectrum of free massless fields of all spins. We augmented it by adding all the on-shell independent derivatives and called that unfolding. Then we learned a bit about twisters in the sitter and how a twister at a point decomposes into left-handed and right-handed spinners. And all this allowed us to package all of these different fields into a single scalar master field of spacetime point x and the twister y, which contains the component fields as Taylor coefficients. Then we introduced the Harrispin algebra of star products on y space, okay, which is an infinite dimensional symmetry algebra that contains the isometry algebra of translations and rotations at a point. And this allowed us to rewrite the field equation for all of this stuff, including these relations and the original field equations and consistencies and so on, in one short line with a star product like so, where I've stealthily switched to differential form language. So instead of nabla alpha alpha dot, we now just say that the derivative is d, and stuck a dx on the right-hand side. And then we looked at it, concluded that this means that the variation of the master field under translations is given by an anticommutator with this translation generator. Well, rotations are generated by an ordinary commutator with the rotation generator, which then we generalized into the transformation property under general Harrispin symmetry transformations, that is, general functions of y. And so far, this is a global symmetry since we don't have gauge potentials yet. Okay, then we said we want a zero on the right-hand side of the field equation. So we introduced some more machinery, these kappas, which I haven't named, I think, last time, but they're called Klein operators. Okay? And the star product with them Fourier transforms, and the double-sided star product flips the sign of y, just like here in the gauge transformation. Okay? The individual kappas are spacetime dependent, because the split into y and y bar is. Their product, kappa kappa bar, is spacetime independent. It's talking about the entire twister. And it has this nice algebraic property that it commutes or anti-commutes with the quantities of even or odd spin, which will be handy. OK, and this allowed us to rewrite the master field equation as just a constancy condition, where now C star kappa is a function in twister space only, called the twister transform of our fields. Okay, now we are forced to choose a handedness, either C star kappa or C star kappa bar. But once we've chosen with these guys, the field equation is simpler, and they have cleaner transformation properties under the group. Instead of this twisted commutator, it's an ordinary commutator. Okay, that's where we stand. So now, how do we do interactions? So I told you last time that this algebra, the algebra of star commutators for functions of y, is the gauge group of Harrispin theory. That was a lie designed to keep you hopeful. Okay. This group by itself is relevant as the global symmetry group of the linearized theory, and it is also the global symmetry group of the free CFT in the situations when we're dual to a free CFT holographically, but it is not the local gauge group of the interacting theory. So what's the correct way to think about this? Well, the notion is that this algebra defines the geometry of twister space, which is non-commutative because of the nature of this product. Okay, and this is the simplest geometry you can write on it. So this is a flat geometry of twister space. I learned. So what we'll need to do in an interacting theory, as usual, in places where geometry enters physics, we will need to curve this geometry of twister space as encoded by the star product algebra, and relate the curvature to our field strength C, which so far has only been living on the flat geometry in twister space. So after we figure out how to curve the twister space, space-time dependence will be the easy part. So just like in this story here, after you understand what's the correct structure to look at in twister space, space-time dependence becomes trivial. And if you want to recover the original local fields that sit in C, you just need to multiply by kappa, the appropriate one at every point, and you recover them. So we'll get something similar. The hard problem is in twister space. So how do you curve something? Well, you know, we go and sit in a time machine, and we go and ask Riemann. And Riemann will say, my children, you need to come up with some locally flat framework and then introduce local curvature somehow related to derivatives of something. Yeah, but we can't do that. Because we have a non-commutative space with this non-local star product, and I don't know how to deform that locally. It looks too rigid. So we step back into the time machine, and we go back a bit further, and we talk to Gauss. And Gauss says, I don't know what is all this about local Riemannian locally flat stuff. I know that curved spaces are just shapes inside larger flat spaces. That's how Gauss understood curved surfaces. Okay, and this we will be able to do. So the strategy is going to be to enlarge the twister space and the star product algebra on it, view the original one as something flatly embedded into the larger one, and then curve the embedding. And that is what Vasilyev's equations do. So how do we enlarge the twister space? Well, there's basically one thing that we can use, which is the twister metric given to us by the geometry. So the simplest thing we can do is double it. So we'll say that in addition to the y's, which have commutator given by the twister metric, we will also introduce an extra twister coordinate z with the same commutator. And here people put a sign by convention. You can get rid of it by changing z by a phase if you want, but this is the convention everyone uses. And we'll just have them commute with each other. Very good. Now, as we know from the simpler case up there, this leaves us with a certain freedom define the so-called ordinary commutative product, which will do the encoding of these algebra elements into ordinary functions. The star product is the fundamental structure, but we can also decide that it is related to an ordinary product, yy, like the one we have up there. And similarly for the z's. With a minus. And now, what is yz? It is the same as z star y. They commute. And well, of course, we will decide that this will be denoted by the ordinary product yz. Except we don't. Okay, we decide instead that there is a shift between the star product and the ordinary product defined like this, with an extra metric piece. This doesn't spoil anything. The ordinary product is still commutative. The commutator of the star product is still perfectly fine. Okay, so there is this weird choice. It will have advantages technically, as we will see later. So for now, we will emphasize that it is at heart only a convention. It's only the commutators that matter. And for people who care, we will say that this choice arises naturally if you think of it as normal ordering for the operators y plus z and y minus z. Okay, so we've enlarged the space. Very nice. Now, our old-fashioned functions of y only that we want to embed into the larger space can now be expressed as functions in the large space that happen to commute with z. Right? Because the thing that commutes with z is y, and z doesn't commute with itself. So if you commute with z, you depend on y only. So what we are going to do is we are going to curve this embedding of the small twister space into the large one by replacing the z over here, which is defining the embedding, by a dynamical field that can depend on everything. So that's the main idea, and in the whole rest of the lecture, this is what we'll be doing.
Thinking about the combination y and z as like the larger twister space?
Y and z together make up the larger space, yes.
And y is the smaller one that we're embedding?
Y is the flat smaller one, and now we're going to define a curved smaller one by saying it's not just the y space, it's whatever is commuting with this s. But it can still be parameterized in terms of y because it's the same size. At least roughly, I may have lied a little bit. Okay. So what do we do with our field strength? We extend it into a master field, which we will now call B, that is allowed to be a function also of z. But for now, it won't actually be a function of z. It will remain equal to this function of y. And only later, when we introduce the interactions, it will go into z space. So we also want to encode the fact that for now, before curving, this B depends on y only, and this is how we write it. Okay? However, it's not how we should be writing it. Because remember, the C is not the guy with the simple transformation properties. It's the C star kappas. They're the ones living in the adjoint representation that doesn't depend on the point and so forth. So instead of writing something like this, we will take the we will use analogs of C star kappa, so we will have B star kappa and B star kappa bar. Where this kappa now lives in both y space and z space. So it's the delta function of left-handed y times the delta function of left-handed z. Okay, and now we get the first dividend out of this strange choice that y star z is not the same as yz. Because once you disentangle the star product, it's no longer a delta function. But it collapses magically into an ordinary function, which looks like exponent yz. Okay.
This is an identity or this is a definition?
This is an identity. Okay. And then.
It's a new kappa.
It's a new kappa. The old kappa was kappa y, and this is kappa just kappa. Yes?
Little z
what
little y is to big y.
Yeah.
So even though you've enlarged the space, at a point it's still
a graph. At a point, you now have two twisters, and each, so y decomposes into little y bar, and z decomposes into little z bar. Yeah, x. Okay, and now multiplying by kappa, which used to be a Fourier transform, is now a simple algebraic operation. So it's an ordinary product by the exponent, and then inside the function, it does this funny thing, where the signs aren't important. What's important is that it takes the function and replaces left-handed y with left-handed z inside. But it's still an algebraic operation, no more distributions, no more Fourier transforms, no more integrals. Very good. As before, a two-sided product.
So that you can't do with
that I can't do with y's only. Yeah, and the two-sided product flips the sign of left. Exactly.
That you don't know how to define it.
Exactly. I don't have contours anymore. It's all analytic.
But there's always a conservation of mass somehow. So there's a magic trick here. How can? Where is it gone? Is it completely disappeared? Or because this is usually the mass experiment. It's very nice, but is it really completely gone?
Haven't thought about it hard enough. So maybe the ambiguity in the Penrose transform is hidden in the ambiguity of how you define this entanglement between the y's and the z's.
You're saying once you define these guys, then this whole crap about Penrose transform is gone.
Yeah. Hmm. OK. So I know. Isn't this fun?
That sounds OK. OK. It's good, but is it OK?
Good.
There's always nothing is for free. Okay,
Laurent, I love you, but I'm in a hurry. All right. So we have these kappas, and as before, we can combine the left kappa and the right kappa into something position independent. So it's e to the I capital Y capital Z, position independent. Where did we have that? Over there, it commutes or anti-commutes with integer or half integer spin functions. And I, of course, got confused and already included the Z's here. Well, they only apply here. But you get the point. OK, so where were we? We want to rewrite this condition that the field strength is still only y dependent using the smarter multiplied by kappa representation. So we can read off from this operation that having b independent on all of capital Z can be re-encoded as B star kappa. This will depend on small z because small z starts mixing itself into here. But B star kappa would still be independent on right-handed z, and B star kappa bar will be independent on left-handed z. Okay, so. So this statement that our master field lives still in the original smaller space can now be written as this pair of commutators. Very good. Okay, now, so what we want to do is to replace the flat Z embedding by a field S. Well, the first thing to do, of course, is to erase the Z's and replace them by S's. Okay, but first, still before turning on the interactions, we want to be able to express that this S is the same as Z, still the same, it may be up to gauge or something, which means it has to satisfy the same commutator algebra as Z does. So we just will append to these conditions. Just so the commutator of left-handed S with left-handed S must be the same as left-handed Z with left-handed Z, since we have this anti-symmetric metric in spinner space, we might as well also write it as a trace. So the commutator of left-handed with left-handed has to stay 2i. Likewise, right-handed with right-handed, and zero commutator between the two. So this is a rewriting of saying that the S's have the same commutator with themselves as the original Z's. Okay, and I just decomposed it into left-handed and right-handed pieces.
The first part, you went from D to D from kappa.
Yeah. So that will be useful in a minute.
Here you studied that your field is commuting with B. So commuting with B would be star kappa the same?
No. So okay. B wants to commute with the Z. Yeah. But I don't want to talk about B. That's not the nice object. The nice object is B star kappa. Now, B star kappa, when B is dependent only on Y, B star kappa will have some left-handed Z mixed into it, but still not right-handed Z. So it will still be independent on right-handed Z. And on the other hand, B star kappa bar will have some Z bar mixed into it by the product, but will still be independent on Z. So I can write the embedding condition as a pair of commutators like this, and then I'm replacing Z by S, while still not curving. Okay, and this line is encoding that I haven't yet curved. Okay, well now let's curve. So, what do we do? Let's make room. Okay, so we want to curve this algebra of the S's, which is determining how the twister space is embedded in the larger flat one. And the curvature has to be described somehow by the field strength. The field strength is encoded in this great big scalar function. So, well, I need to just stick scalars somehow in here. And there are two nice scalars, one associated with somehow the left-handed space and one associated somehow with the right-handed space. And there are two places here where I can stick in a scalar. Very nice. So we deform the left-handed commutator by some function of B star kappa, where this star means that when I say function, I mean it's a Taylor series with star products, not ordinary products, because that makes more sense algebraically. And here, some other function of B star kappa bar. And if I want this whole system to have real solutions, then this must be the complex conjugate function. OK, that's it. We did it. So this is interacting higher spin theory at a single point. Still no space-time dependence, but that's what it is in twister space. Okay, so these equations turn out to be consistent for any odd function f. Otherwise, there are some contradictions between the commutators. Not all choices of f are inequivalent, because there is some freedom to perform field redefinitions on what b means. So the inequivalent choices can be parameterized as u times phase, which is an even function of u or a function of u squared. Every such choice, every choice of f, will give a different version of higher spin theory, okay, a different version of the interactions. Now, there are only two choices, however, that conserve parity. Yeah?
Sorry, I just missed one. Those choices of f are inequivalent. So you're saying those are the only?
Those are the only inequivalent ones. Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. By field redefinition, you can always bring it to such a form.
Okay.
Very good. And there are only two choices that satisfy parity. So basically, parity wants the same thing to be written in the left-handed and right-handed sectors. So it wants f to be plus or minus f bar if you go through it carefully. So parity leaves us only with the choices f of u equals u and f of u equals iu. Okay. With this choice, we get master fields, or in particular, the scalar component that is parity even, and with this choice, it's parity odd. So this is what I meant when I said that parity together with higher spin symmetry seems to determine the theory uniquely. We have only two ways that we know of to write equations for higher spin theory that conserves parity. Okay. You mean consistency if you start multiplying by other things?
Yeah.
It's almost obvious. So to go through it carefully, you also need to keep track of the fact that b should be an integer spin, so an even function of y and z. S is a non-half integer spin. And to keep track of the rules for commuting with kappa kappa bar and so forth, but it works.
Yeah, essentially it's a commuting operator.
Yeah.
So how is it encoded
into b when you extend twister space that is a function of
even
integer spin? So I just said nothing fancy, just that b of minus y minus z is b of y z, and s has a minus.
The coupling constant.
And the coupling constant is, yes, the coefficient here. OK, so now the next thing to say is that now that we expressed B as the curvature of this potential S that determines the geometry in twister space. Yeah? I am mostly waving my hands because I don't know the correct words in non-commutative geometry, but I am trying to say that that algebra of the y's defines the flat geometry of twister space, and now I'm trying to curve it by messing with the commutators in a consistent way. So a coupling constant can be hidden in a constant coefficient either here in front or here. You can still choose a coupling constant, but yes, but yeah, you can do that. But classically, as in GR, the value of the coupling constant doesn't actually change what the solutions look like because it's dimensionful. No, there's a single couple, which you can identify with the Newton's constant, if you want.
But that's not a, that shouldn't appear in the classical equations. That should be an overall scaling of the action.
So you can throw it away by field redefinition. You can rescale what you mean by B and get rid of this coupling. Okay, so classically, as in GR, it's not actually playing a role. Right. But you can put it in there, and it will play a role quantum mechanical.
That's not a real.
Yeah, like in pure GR. Okay. So now we can make all this more compact by saying that, okay, now S is our fundamental field, and B is derived from it. I mean, from the start, this contains only field strengths, and they're not supposed to be fundamental. So we can write the equations more compactly by solving for B. So we can just write something like inverse of F on this equals inverse of F bar on the right-handed guy. Which we simply define star kappa bar, which we simply define as B. And then the only other equation is that the left-handed S and the right-handed S commute. So this is the minimal set of equations that we have at a point. And the dynamics, the interactions, as we've been saying, is sitting here. That is, the meat of the dynamics is encoded as a relation between the curvatures of the left-handed and right-handed sectors. Okay. So it's just the statement that it's the same B here and here. Okay.
Could you have a theory which is purely chiral, that is, F bar is trivial and uniform here? Just to be F bar.
Yeah, if you want real solutions, then no. But that's always the answer, yeah, because chiral solutions are complex.
Yeah, chiral solutions are complex. So it's possible. Anyway, you haven't looked at it.
No, I haven't. OK. Now, the last thing to do is that this is all about commutators, which means it is gauge invariant under rotating everything in the same way under the algebra. So we have a gauge invariance of our equations with the functions now both of y and z, integer spin functions. Otherwise, it doesn't quite work, which says that S transforms in the adjoint. So does B star kappa. Well, B itself, as before, has the ugly transformation law where you need to flip the left-handed spinners. In the gauge parameter. Okay, so these are the equations. Now, the next question is how many solutions do they have? That is, are we still describing the same degrees of freedom? So in the linearized theory, we said that the solution space is spanned by C of y. Which is the on-shell inequivalent Taylor series of all the field strength at any one point. And this is still true. So we haven't lost or gained degrees of freedom, and at least perturbatively. So the game works in the following way. So first, you decide that like the original notion of the field strength in Y space acts as initial conditions in the larger space. So we just define C of Y as B of y at 0. Then the leading order solution, that is the linearized one with nothing curved yet, as we've already seen, is that at first order, B is still C of y with no z dependence, while S at zeroth order is just z. So we feed in this leading order solution into the equation and solve perturbatively. Where what is it that we're solving? So we have commutators with s all over the place, and it so happens that the commutator with zeroth order s is the commutator with z is just the derivative with respect to z. Because again, if you don't depend on z, you commute with it. Okay, so what we get in this perturbative scheme is we get differential equations in z space that can be solved. And they have been solved at some leading orders, and you can do a general analysis of their structure that shows that all this determines B and S in the entire big twister space. Uniquely from the initial data C up to gauge. Now, the gauge freedom can be fixed so that the evolution in the Z space really is unique by choosing a gauge condition. There's some freedom here, and Vasilyev likes a particular gauge condition. Which is that z times s remains zero to all orders. Okay, and with this gauge, every choice of initial data C of y evolves uniquely. But there is a residual gauge freedom, which transforms the C of y itself. So residual gauge freedom that is parameterized precisely by one function of y and it relates gauge equivalent curvature data. Okay, so this is the curved version that I promised of the original higher spin gauge group. Okay, we have in the original twister space the degrees of freedom encoded in C of y. They are acted on by this residual gauge symmetry, which is the same size as the original group, but the structure constants of this group are now deformed and field dependent. And then you are sort of left free to take your pick. You can either decide that it is the YZ picture with the nice equations that is fundamental, and the Y picture is a shadow of it with some ugly curved gauge group that no one can even write down explicitly. Or you can decide that this picture is fundamental because these are the physical degrees of freedom. There are original fields that we can measure. And this is just elaborate machinery to produce the only possible consistent equations on these physical degrees of freedom. Okay. And another thing to say again is that this procedure of involving everything in Z-space is only possible because of the funny convention that we had for the Y times Z product, because it got rid of distributions and made everything sort of just analytic functions in twister space of which you can take derivatives and so on. Okay, and now we are ready for the space-time dependence. So this is a good time for questions.
When you say cannot write this book, what did you? What is known about this
book? That it's the same size as the original one. Its structure constants, just as the interactions themselves in Y language, are known to maybe a couple of orders. Yes, and it is known that it has an undeformed Lorentz subgroup, which is important in a couple of contexts, and we may get to it in the remaining time. So basically, the undeformed Lorentz subgroup says that you are still dealing with the local relativistic fields, and you haven't messed
when
that
you
up.
Say it's a group, it's really a real. There's also constants and not
constants. Right, but they are in this Lorentz subset. All right. So everything I said up to now has been in my own funny language. But not mine. So this is all true for standard Vasiliev theory. Now that we come to talk about space-time dependence, there is a choice to make. So, and because of time constraints, I will give you my version because we are conceptually closer to it and it won't involve any zigzags. So
this is the way Vasiliev framed it.
This is the way Vasiliev framed it, and it's also the way I frame it. The difference comes in the space-time dependence. So he has space-time that is fluid and gauged, and I have still the same fixed De Sitter space-time in which we have been living all along. And I will relate to the standard picture in the very end. Okay, so in the linearized theory, we had a constant C star kappa, and then the space-time dependence was just to multiply by kappa back at each point to get the local fields there. Now, this is no longer that simple, because now our more fundamental variable is not C star kappa y, but B star kappa, which contains both kappa and y and kappa z. So in the linearized limit, this becomes C star kappa y star kappa z, where the kappa z has its own x dependence. So this constancy is ruined. Also, in curved space, what does it mean to have spinners like S and S bar constant? So the next best thing, instead of having all this structure constant in spacetime, is to have it constant up to gauge. To say that we have the same curved twister space at every point up to a gauge rotation. So this is what we're going to do. So let's start expressing this. So we want to say that the covariant derivative, say, of S in our De Sitter space is the same as a gauge rotation with some connection. Okay, so there's a zero covariant derivative. And likewise for S bar. And then likewise for the derivative of B star kappa, say. Where we condense the notation a little bit. So this nabla without indices is just the covariant derivative packaged into a one form. We need a covariant derivative for the spinner. For a scalar, we can use the ordinary derivative. And this W is some connection field. Let's just use mu's better. That can, again, depend on everything. Okay, and this is the last field that we're going to introduce. So there are three master fields in the theory. There is the B, which you can get rid of if you want. It's derivative from S. So S is the potential in twister space. And the W is the gauge potential in space-time. And that's all there is. All right. So this means that our structure here is it's constant in space-time up to gauge transformations. Now, we need to also know something about the gauge potential W. Because for this derivative equals zero equation to be consistent, the curvature of W has to cancel out the curvature of nabla. Because the nabla is a curved derivative in the De Sitter, and it has a commutator. So nabla, nabla rotates S. So therefore, the curvature of W must also rotate S. Now, here comes in a nice fact. So we talked before about rotation generators that implement the Lorentz rotation on the twister coordinates. So we know from before that yy Lorentz rotates the y's. And similarly, the z's up to sine Lorentz, so the product of 2z, Lorentz rotates z when commuted with the star product. And it so happens that despite the curvature that we introduced into the algebra here, the same is true for S. So S doesn't commute, so we need to symmetrize the product. Lorentz rotates itself. So that means that we now know how to realize the fact that the connection should have a curvature that rotates S to balance the rotation from the just the derivative in the curved De Sitter space. So this then brings us to the last equation, which is that the curvature of W in form language must be, with all the factors taken care of and so forth, the wedge product of two dx's with this Lorentz generator S times S. Actually, the symmetrization is already automatic. Don't need it. Plus the same but right-handed. OK. So that's it. Okay. These are the interacting equations of higher spin theory in my version. So 1, 2, 3, and all this. And they are still living on pure De Sitter. So now let's analyze this new structure that we introduced and say a little bit about what it does. What is this W? What sits inside it? So B, we know. In B sit the physical field strengths C. Now, S, we know that it's gauge. It can be completely solved for up to gauge once you know the field strength. Now, what is W? So just like we could solve the Z evolution from C of Y to B of YZ, we can likewise solve the Z evolution for the connection. So we can denote just the Y dependence part of the connection like this, and evolve it using our this equation into the whole thing in the large twister space. Again, using the same gauge fixing and so forth. So now we have a new field in the original Y space that we best give some meaning to. So in the large space, in the YZ picture with the simple equations, we have B, S, and W. In the original physical Y space, without simple equations, S disappears, and we have C of Y and the connection field omega. Now, C contains the field strengths and all of their independent derivatives. Well, omega, of course, contains ordinary space-time gauge potentials. So at linear order, it contains the potentials for the field strengths and the right-handed ones that sit inside C. Okay, and to see how that happens, it's best to start with simple low spin examples. So that's so spin two. So again, we look at the different Taylor coefficients in omega as a function of y. So for spin two, the relevant ones are the coefficient of y, y bar, and yy with y bar y bar. So this piece we will of course call the perturbation to the metric or the Wheelbine. On shell, its derivative gives the perturbation to the spin connection, and then a further second derivative will give the wild tensor as encoded in the field strength master field. Okay, for spin one, we just have the gauge potential. We only need this form index that already sits on the omega. We don't need any powers of y. And that, after one derivative, becomes the field strength. Okay, so in general, spin s is described by the piece in omega that's that has 2s minus 2 powers of y. And we can treat the balanced yy bar piece as the fundamental potential, like the ordinary gauge potential and the Wheelbine. And the others are its derivatives on shell. S minus one derivatives, and the S derivative is already given the field strength. Okay, so all these potentials sitting inside omega, together with the field strength and all their derivatives sitting inside C, basically complete the democracy of all the possible ways to encode the spin s degree of freedom with fields. You can encode it with this potential or with any of the intermediate potentials like the spin connection that are its derivatives, or you can jump straight to the field strength, or you can look at its derivatives. And okay, so these are all the possibilities. And I will just mention that after doing all this song and dance of solving for the Z dependence, it is possible I'll just stay here. It is possible to, in principle, to obtain field equations simply for the physical x and y space fields. So we know from analyzing the tractable equations in xyz space that there exist some equations, again in this unfolded first order form, that are first order in derivatives, but have these terrible algebraic sort of potentials on the right hand side that nobody knows except for first couple of orders out of solving the Z equations. So the statement is, not that you should care about these equations personally, because I can't even write them down explicitly, but the statement is that this full democracy of representations of a spin-less degree of freedom as fields, you know, all the field strengths and the derivatives and all the different potentials, is the minimal number of fields that you need in the story in order to be able to write the theory as local differential equations. Okay. And then the Z space is added on sort of to make the equations tractable. Okay. And in all this and in all that, still a solution is completely determined up to gauge by C of y at any one point, because that's the Taylor series for the field strings. So now I want to go into maybe 2 minutes of overtime, if you'll allow me, and compare what we've done so far. Let's make it all visible. area. With the standard form of the Vasiliev equations. Okay. So what Vasiliev says is, forget about all this picture of the Sitter space as a hyperboloid in five dimensions. Forget all these local 4D frames that are embedded inside the global 5D frame and rotate and so on. We don't need any of that. Because look, we have the Wheelbine and the spin connection as a part of our fields. Okay, let's do what GR does and just define the geometry, whether it's the Sitter as the simplest solution or whatever it wants to be, using this Wheelbine and spin connection. So that the geometry is no longer sitting in this rigid 5D structure that we've been talking about, just in the space-time connection W, which contains in particular the metric. Now, once you have that, then you can think of the local 4D frames as being the same everywhere. It's just that the spin connection tells you how to rotate between them and so forth, but you don't need the 5D story. You don't need the X dependence of the decomposition of a twister into a pair of spinners. You can decide that it's the same decomposition everywhere because the X dependence is coming from the different orientations of the 4D frame inside the 5D frame. And so basically, you can get rid of this whole right-hand side, which has to do with the rotation of the frame and the hyperboloid. There is no more hyperboloid. These covariant derivatives we don't need anymore. They're the curved covariant derivatives in the Sitter. We got rid of the Sitter. It's encoded over here in the connection, so we can just replace them by ordinary derivatives. And these are the Vasiliev equations. Okay. Now, one funny consequence is that if we do this, if we let go of rigid the Sitter, then we've really let go of spacetime all the way. So we started off saying we're just doing what general relativity does and encode spacetime with the Wheelbine and so on, but we've done something much, much worse. We wrote all these equations, which are, what are they? So this is zero curvature, this is zero gauge covariant derivative, this is zero gauge covariant derivative. So for every solution, I can choose a gauge where the connection is just zero. Oh, yeah, sure. I'm not saying that these fields are equal to the fields, but they play the same role. Locally, you can write a map, but it's not the God-given one. So we can choose a gauge where the connection is simply zero, and there is no space-time dependence, which means that the metric that is a component of this connection is zero. So you have now demoted space-time into a gauge artifact. It's just your insistence to describe a flat connection with something other than the obvious zero choice. But because you know that the connection is flat, you can always gauge it to the zero connection. Okay, and technically this is what people always do when they actually carry out calculations for things like endpoint functions in higher spin theory. They always go to this gauge. And its existence is a remarkable fact, which I just wanted to point out. So in this picture, space-time is just a 4D set of gauge frames.
So in this picture, omega zero things, whether it corresponds to what
choice? In this picture, omega W equals zero is not a solution.
This W equals zero, where does it correspond?
Nothing, because there's no canonical mapping. I mean, you can only map up to gauge. So there's You can't, you can't take two gauge, a gauge here and a gauge here and ask, are they the same?
I'm asking, what does it correspond to? You tell me you have a map between the subject.
Well, you can ask maybe what is the most similar thing that I can do. So perhaps the most similar thing that I can do is to choose a gauge where, so this equation here says that my B star kappa is covariantly constant. So I can choose a gauge in which it actually is constant, in which the commutator with W is everywhere zero. But W itself still cannot be zero because it has this non-zero curvature.
What is the irreducible choice? What choice, what simple choice solves the third equation? How do you solve the third equation? That's an example.
That's what I'm asking. Without wasting too much time, I can only give it to you at zeroth order, because higher orders will actually involve solving the differential equations in Z-space to do anything. At zeroth order, it's proportional to ZZ. So at the, like, for the background empty De Sitter solution, there is a canonical choice of what the connection should be, but not generally. I think that's that. Thanks for sticking around. So now someone should learn the holographic story and teach the rest of us about it.